From the heart of Montana, this is Big Sky, Small World, Career College's student podcast. Big Sky, Small World, I can only have Montana.
Yo, what's going on, everybody? It is Starting Five. It is Scotty McIntyre, where we cover your recent sports news and sports events. Today, it's good to be back, honestly. I haven't been here in a while. It's been a long couple of weeks, a long weeks of sports, long weeks of events. And here to cover, just because last week NBA basketball just started back up again, and there were some big events that happened. So we're going to cover basically everything that is NBA related and everything that has to do with the NBA. It's early morning today, and we're going to be discussing these big breakouts and, you know, big NBA news that's been happening. So, for the Los Angeles Lakers, Luka Doncic opened the season with back-to-back 40-point-plus games, 43 in the opener, 49 in the next game. Also had a double-digit rebounds and assists in those games, making him the first player in NBA history to begin a season with consecutive games of 40-plus and 10-plus rebounds and 5-plus assists. And then also, Vija Edgecombe made a sensational debut for the Philadelphia 76ers, 34 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists in his first game, setting the franchise rookie debut scoring record, surpassing the mark set by Allen Iverson and ranking third most in NBA debut history. The league notes that there are also 11 players that average 30-plus points through the first 6 days of the season, pointing to an unusually high scoring start. Are we seeing shift in pace slash defense that is enabling these numbers, or is it an anomaly? I think not only a shift in pace in defense, I don't really think that, you know, defense is a big issue that the NBA has, honestly. I think the big shift that has been made are the different skill sets that people have developed in the past couple of years, because you see multiple people with, you know, who only have one skill on their game, and then the next 2 years later they add three different things, four different things, five different things. They just keep adding on and on because these guys are getting smarter and smarter and smarter. Where, you know, back then in the 80s it was all a physical game where all you did was people, like, teams would have post players, center players, they would sign center players to sit. They would literally assign players to sit at the block and literally just foul people, which is just stupid. When nowadays a center is basically made to control your offense or literally get every single rebound and get everything. I mean, it's the game has evolved so much at every single position that you really just don't even know how to compare the two, honestly. Shift in pace, you're seeing players who are getting more skilled. Like, you see Vija Edgecombe, who has probably one of the most athletic players coming out of this year's draft class. And not only that, but also with Dylan Harper and Cooper Flagg, obviously, which we'll get onto in a minute. But you see all these amazing young guys that are coming into the NBA and having already great games. They're already having games, and they're already proving themselves to everyone, and they're already showing everybody that even though I'm only 18 years old, I can go out and compete with these guys who are 31, 32, 33 years old, who've had experience in the NBA for almost a decade. And you don't really see that out of a lot of, you know, young guys with a lot of young talent. I mean, the only times that we've ever really kind of seen someone come out so aggressively, like in their first season, when they didn't really have too much expectation to do really, really well, are, you know, people like Michael Jordan or Allen Iverson. Not saying that Michael Jordan didn't have expectations, but nobody expected him to average 30 points this rookie season. But, you know, you see a bunch of stuff like that, and then Luka without LeBron, which is basically their sole offense. LeBron is the system for the Lakers. So not having your system being, you know, fully set in stone in your lineup isn't very helpful. But you also have, you know, one of the best overseas players and one of the best players in the NBA playing for your team, who has led a team to the NBA finals already, and someone who can score at will and change a defense. So that helps. And what does Doncic's start say about his position among all-time greats? Well, I mean, we've seen Luka do this year after year, and we haven't seen any sign of him slowing down. We haven't seen any sign of him, you know, doing anything to really change his game because it's worked so well for however long it's been. I think it's his eighth season. Seventh season. And you see no sign of him slowing down. You see a sign of him being able to control a team, any team. And I can say any team because he has played on two different teams with two totally different offenses and two totally different play styles and systems. You can see how he's affected an all-time great team. And his position in all-time greats, the only thing that's holding Luka back are his accolades. You know, like MVP or championships or first-team All-NBAs. Finals MVPs, just all those big, you know, statistical accolades are so hard to get nowadays just because you have, you know, Luka was an MVP voting last year. I think it was fourth, and he was averaging 31 points and 7 rebounds and 7 assists. And you go back a decade ago, and that would get you 7 straight MVPs. And thinking that it's so hard to rank Luka all time against all time greats because he just doesn't have the championships to prove it. He doesn't have the scoring titles to prove it. He doesn't have the MVPs to prove it. He doesn't have the defense to prove it at all, not so far, but you have these all-time great people who've had 13, 14 year careers, or even 15, 16, 17 year careers, who have accomplished so much because they were given time to kind of soak in the NBA. They were kind of given time to adjust their game, and it took them that long. And honestly, with Luka having such a great coach right now in JJ Redick and being a part of such a great program with such a great fan base, and I really don't see the reason that Luka won't be winning a championship in the next couple of years, because all he's going to do is just get better and better. You know, after we saw him get into shape in LA and saw what he's able to do in LA without LeBron, you kind of sit there and think for a little bit. You know, this is the first time LeBron has been the second man on his team ever in his career, and he is 40 years old, going on 41. And you just kind of sit back and kind of think, where does this put Doncic all time? And all time, it doesn't really put him really much higher than people think he would, but based on skill, he is definitely one of the most skilled players ever to play the game. Not even a question. I just don't think that you could put him anywhere super high all time right now, because he hasn't played enough, and two, he hasn't won enough. So, I mean, putting him all time is kind of really hard to do and kind of pointless, because you don't have him winning championships already. You don't have him getting multiple MVPs. And you don't see him, and we're only a week into the NBA season, and people are already trying to place him all time off of 2 games that he's played. They've only played 3. He was out last game, and Austin Reeves had a 51 points, 11 rebounds, and 9 assists, or 10 rebounds. And it just shows you how reliable so many of these players can be on this team. And just shows you how valuable Luka is to this team. Because if he's out, you have to rely on someone else to go score 50 points. You have to go rely on people to control the offense, which, you know, Austin Reeves is able to do. But he is still a really young guy and is not a 50-point scorer at all. So having someone to score 50 points just shows you how dominant Luka is in these games and how much of a spotlight should we give rookies, you know, like the rookies that debuted for the last week. You know, you see VJ Edgecombe, you see Cooper Flagg, you see Dylan Harper, and, you know, the league is in very good hands for the next couple of years, and how much of a spotlight should we give rookies like VJ Edgecombe and will they sustain opening explosion? Well, when you come into the NBA with high praise and you drop 34 points, that high praise isn't just a fluke. You don't have guys who are 18, 19 years old dropping 34 points on rookies. I mean, on rookies and vets, especially vets. And like you see in other podcasts, people are saying, Edgecombe looks like he's a 7 to 8 year rookie veteran the way that he's playing. And he was playing the Celtics, who have one of the best offenses and one of the best defenses in the NBA. Obviously, they don't have Tatum, but they have Brown, they have White, they have all these guys who can and easily can match up with VJ Edgecombe. But VJ Edgecombe is just, he was able to, you know, apply his skills to an offense that the Sixers have, which is a fantastic thing to see, because, you know, with the super, super athletic guards who are only, you know, 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", you don't really see those guys, you know, control an offense as much, besides like Russell Westbrook and all those guys. Not comparing him to Russell Westbrook, but it's hard for super, super small athletic guards to go out and really compete because they're not big, or they just can't catch heat. And he caught heat really quickly, and extremely, extremely quickly, actually. So seeing that, you just can't even think about what he's going to be able to accomplish in the next couple of years. And it's super exciting to see all these rookie guys come into the league with high praise and be able to deliver on that praise. And it's super exciting to see out of NBA fans, because you don't really see a lot of super, super young guys come out and really put something up on the board. And him being able to do that is really, really, really promising. And obviously you see this out of a lot of people. Like, you see like how like Wemby did it and a bunch of other players did it, and they were given high praise, but Edgecombe was given not even close, not even remotely, even in the same distance close to as high praise as these guys like Wemby were when they first debuted in the NBA. You kind of just sit and wonder if he's even able to keep it up, because they've only played two games and he had 34 in the first and 19 in the second, which are both fantastic, fantastic games. And you kind of, you know, a lot of NBA fans are, you know, greedy people, and they like to try to, you know, bring you down. They try to say, oh, he didn't average 30 points in the first four games. Like, he's 19. Like, he's adjusting the NBA. And literally all that rookies do is adjust to teams, and they make the small impacts. They make the small adjustments every game over and over and over again. You know, you see guys like Edgecombe who are able to adapt to the offense and the defense so unbelievably well. And obviously in a Sixers team that has needed help for like a lot of help in the past years, Joel Embiid probably becoming one of the most injury prone players in the NBA. You know, we saw that with Anthony Davis and Klay Thompson since they were out for so long, and even with Lonzo Ball. But now playing, you know, only what almost seems like only a dozen games every single season because of injury. But when Embiid's on, he is, in my opinion, he's the best player in the NBA for sure, without even a question. A couple years ago, there was a span of 23 games where he averaged 40 points. And averaging 40 points for a quarter of the NBA season, more than a quarter of the NBA season, is not normal. And that includes 40-point ball, a 50-point ball, and then a 70-point ball on Victor Wembanyama. And it's like he can control the whole offense, but when he's not there for 90% of the time, you can't rely only on Tyrese Maxey to control your whole offense, because they're going to lose every single game if that's the case. Nothing against Tyrese Maxey, but Tyrese Maxey cannot lead a team to anything right now because they don't have their star player. Nothing against Tyrese Maxey, they just don't have people who are able to you know, go out there and perform. And now that you have a guy like Vijay Edgecombe who's averaging whatever it is, 22.5 points for the first two games that they have, and it's not just a fluke because he went and scored 19 in the next game off great efficiency. You can't really complain right now as a Sixers fan. And obviously Joel Embiid's back, but he's been playing like crap, and he really is just out there literally just to hang around at this point. Joel Embiid's got to play better, and if Joel Embiid plays how he usually plays, the Sixers are a unbelievable and fantastic team and are a top three team in the East, no question. But Joel Embiid can never get anything back. So, you know, people who literally, he won an MVP, and then 18 months later, a year and a half later, people were considering him retiring. That's how injury prone the guy is. He wins an MVP, year and a half later, still injured, and then people are saying that he should go and freaking retire, which I think is stupid. And a lot of people don't understand that, because all these players work years and years and years and months and put so much time in their body and so much time into their game, and they get hurt and hurt and hurt. And it's annoying. You see it with Kawhi Leonard all the time. And people are saying, Kawhi should just retire. You don't understand. Like, people don't understand the work and the dedication that people have. You can't just say, oh, I'm hurt for more than a year. Oh, I'm going to go retire and just get my bag from the NBA. That's not how that works. I just think it's so dumb how people try to look into the worst, literally the worst case scenario ever, and you literally just kind of have to sit and just be like, you know, is Joel Embiid ever going to make it back? I'm not wishing anything bad on Joel Embiid. I'm only wishing the best for Joel Embiid, and it's just a matter of when, like, it's literally just a matter of time. Like, can he get it back within the next couple of games? And if he can't get it back within the next couple of games, I guess it's just a ticking time bomb just to see when he even goes off. It's just like constantly, you don't even watch the games, you just check the box scores and just like, oh, Embiid did good, okay, I'm gonna start looking at more stuff into Joel Embiid. And yeah, it just sucks that you can't have an unbelievable star player be able to be healthy, and it just sucks to see that, because you know how great they would be if they were. And then going on to a lot of early team surprises that happened in the NBA this past week. We saw a lot of huge, huge surprises. You see, you know, Oklahoma City Thunder went to double overtime in both of their first two games as an unprecedented feat that you don't see out of a championship team that almost seems like one of the best teams in recent NBA history. You have Victor Wembanyama posted a monster line, 31-14 with blocks and steals, highlighting his generational potential. Not only that, but his 40 points, 15 rebounds, and 4 blocks against Cooper Flagg in Cooper Flagg's debut, which we'll actually go over. And the 76ers Celtics opener with Edgecombe debut was a thriller, showing strong competition right out of the gate. Teams that look like contenders versus teams in rebuild mode, what surprised you the most? I would say the Thunder, probably. I mean, everybody would say that the Thunder surprised you the most just because of how close their games were and how hyped up, you know, their team is. And obviously with J-Dub out, obviously that's not, you know, obviously not great. But you see these teams who come back from championship and they're either hot or they're not. And you never really see in between the lines. You never see the in-between. You see a double overtime with the Thunder and Shea having 35 in the first game and 55 in the second game, which I do believe is a fluke. 55 points, 26 times at the free throw line, 23 points off free throws. Doesn't count as a 55-point game. That is a stupid 55-point game. And the 35 points before was in double OT. I'd hope you score over 35 points in a double OT game. You know, with Shea now having to, you know, prove to him that he's not a one-season wonder, which we all know he isn't. Has been able to do that. He's been able to prove that he's not a one-season wonder. Obviously, with the Thunder's team and their entire young core, you see so much potential out of these guys, and could see, honestly, these guys are easily a repeat team and could be a repeat team for who knows, probably the next 4 to 5 years. You never know. There could be 4 straight championships coming out of this team. It's just a matter of if these guys are all able to stay healthy and play the exact same way. And obviously being signed on huge contracts with J-Dub, Chet, and Shea being signed on to a combined $800 million contracts is just something you just got to hold on to. Hope they don't get hurt, which I don't think they will be. They're very young. I don't think injuries this young are very, very prone to a lot of these guys. But the Thunder, I don't really think that the Thunder are not my favorite team, but I can't really deny how good these teams are. Shea's really good. Chet's really good. J-Dub is really good. All these guys are super, super solid, solid, solid players and stars who play on one team because their team was able to, you know, sit and wait, honestly. You know, with the Thunder 3 years ago having one of the worst, worst teams I have seen in a long time. The fact that they're able to bounce back that fast in 3 years and they still have what seems like 50 first-round draft picks because of, thanks to, you know, Phoenix, which is also not great since Phoenix is my team, but also thanks to Phoenix, they have so many more draft picks. And now it's just like, okay, what are we going to do? We just signed all these guys to major contracts. Like, what do we do? Do we have to cut people? Do we have to take these people off of contracts? Do we have to waive so many of these guys? How are we going to do this? Because we can't just, I mean, we have these draft picks. You can't trade it for money. Like, that's not how, you can't do that. Like, what are we going to do? The Oklahoma City Thunder are in good hands until what seems like 2040. And these guys are going to become, and probably have already become, a dynasty in the NBA. Shea winning finals MVP, MVP, and a championship in 1 year, which has only happened to a couple NBA players. He's seen all-time great player in Shea, all-time great scorer in J-Dub, all-time defense in Lou Dort, all-time pretty much everything combined together. They're just a well-oiled machine. They're just able to go out there and beat any team with with 68 wins last season, what seems to be probably a repeat of the exact same thing. And really, I don't see this team getting any worse. The only thing that I can see them doing is getting any better. Okay, so we're going to talk about Victor Wembanyama, and this will probably be the biggest part in this entire podcast, just about my thoughts on Victor Wembanyama and him putting up these monster scores, monster scoreboards, monster box scores. And my opinion on Victor Wembanyama is that he is, without even a question, in my opinion, the best player in the NBA right now. And a lot of people really think that that's kind of bogus, just because you have Luka averaging 45 a game and you have Shea averaging 40 a game and Wemby's averaging 35 a game. But one thing that I think that people see, and that I think that Wemby has had so much of an impact from last year to this year already, and you already can see it so well. You see Wemby putting up 40 points, 14 rebounds, and was it 4 or 6 blocks, I don't remember, in his debut for the season. And what I think was probably one of the most entertaining games I have seen an NBA player play in so long, because you do not see a guy who is 7'5", basically playing point guard, controlling an entire offense at 7'5", while controlling the defensive end as well. Wemby is, without a question, MVP, in my opinion, stands for what it should stand for, most valuable player. And I think that Wemby is the most valuable player in the NBA and the most valuable player to his team, because they're 3-0, the first 3-0 start that San Antonio has had in a long time. You don't see them slowing down with Dylan Harper. You don't see them slowing down with Stephon Castle, all these young guys. They could three-peat rookie of the years. And with De'Aaron Fox hurt, you see Wemby come out of the game, foul out of the game, and his team was able to pull through and was able to score. Really just shows that this team is a contender. This team is a contender, not even a question. Not just because of Wemby, but because of super young athletic guards. And De'Aaron Fox is still out. De'Aaron Fox is going to come back, and they're even going to be even better. You have a rookie of the year coming off of the bench, and you have another what seems to almost be rookie of the year, Dylan Harper, who put up 15 points and 4 rebounds on his first game for a debut of a guard who's a lefty into a brand new system with one of the best players in the NBA right now, is a fantastic box score to put up. So Wemby puts up, and then in the next game, he puts up 29, 11, and 2 assists with probably multiple steals and multiple blocks, which I would assume. And you see Wemby play so unbelievably well through these past games. You see him score at will, what basically seems at will, every single game. And he's able to control an offense. He's able to pass. He's able to rebound. He controls the whole offense because he's so big and he can handle the ball. He can pass. He is able to play every single ounce at the defensive end. In my opinion, will Victor Wembanyama be the best defensive player of the year for multiple years to come? Seven straight years? Yeah, I really do. But a lot of people really turn toward the only problem that he would face that I think would be a big issue, which I don't really think is a big issue, is voter fatigue. And a lot of people really, really thought that they saw that with, you know, him losing Rookie of the Year to Rudy Gobert. Granted, Wemby missed multiple games in the NBA season. He was injured. He wasn't, and he also wasn't able to win the award because he didn't play enough games the NBA season with the new NBA rules. He wasn't able to play enough games, so therefore he wasn't even eligible for the award anyways in the first place. And with Wemby going on in training and making his body stronger and stronger, you don't really see a sign of him getting injured anytime soon. Voter fatigue is also a really is a huge thing. It's a huge thing that you see with, you know, Nikola Jokic, who lost his MVP to Joel Embiid, which I do think that Nikola Jokic, without even a question, should have won the MVP. And you see Nikola Jokic, runner-up, who had one of the best statistical seasons he's ever had, lose an MVP to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who led a team, like I just said, 68 wins in an NBA Finals and a title. And he won the Finals MVP, which, without even a question, he should have. But voters fatigue is a huge thing that a lot of people see, because, you know, you don't like to give out seven straight championships. But Victor Wembanyama was voted by GMs the best defensive player in the NBA by 80% of GMs. And we've never seen that before in the NBA. Like, you have Dwight Howard, who was one of the best defensive weapons that the NBA has ever seen at the prime of his career, has only had 78% of the first place votes to be the best player on defense in the NBA. And Wemby, who's only in his third season, has already gathered more than he has. And we don't even know if Wemby's hit his prime. Wemby probably isn't even close to hitting his prime. And that's so unbelievable to me. He's a guy who's able to shoot. He's a guy who's able to play defense. And he's, without even a question, the best defensive player in the NBA. And you see signs of him getting better and better every single day with his training, with his mental training, with Kevin Garnett, with his post-move scoring with Hakeem. And him winning the championship for seven straight seasons, he's going up against players on defense like Rudy Gobert, like all these vets. But in 6 or 7 years, those guys aren't even going to be in the NBA. If you put a statistical board of Wemby on defense, you see a huge, huge board of all these defensive talents. But most of these guys that are on the top are close to retiring, or probably won't even be that big of a defensive weapon just because of their own age fatigue. And Victor Wembanyama, without even a bit of hesitation, is not only the best player now, but will be the best defensive player for the next decade. And one of the best post defenders. He is a great perimeter defender because he doesn't really need to be quick. The guy's just tall. He has an 8'1" wingspan, and he's 7'5". Like, you don't need a lot much else than that. And what I hate when people say he's not just good, he's not good because he's a good basketball player. He's only good because he's tall, which I think is a bit of a stretch. Obviously, he gains a lot of his talent just because he is tall, yes. But he is shooting the ball like a shooting guard. He's shooting the ball like a point guard. He's shooting the ball more efficiently every single season that we see him shoot the ball. And it's just stupid to me that people would say that, because people say Wemby's only good because he's tall. Okay, Curry's only good because he can shoot. That doesn't make any sense, because there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of amazing shooters in the NBA, like Kyle Korver. Kyle Korver can shoot. He ain't no Steph Curry. Wemby is a phenomenon. Wemby is a 7'5" phenomenon. People who are over 7 feet tall always, 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 always get injured. What I think we see the difference in Wemby is that it is so much later in the history of the NBA that they have gathered so much medical information about these athletes. They've been able to gather information about injuries. They're able to gather information about all these guys that who are so tall. And Wemby has gone through so much training and so much hard work that you almost don't even see like a chance of him even being injured at all, because you see the videos of him almost snapping his ankle on some plays, but getting up and being fine because he has trained his body like that. Like, he has been able to work with the best people, the best coaches, the best trainers, you know, the best veterans about his physical game, his mental game, and his overall physical and mental health. Something like that out of a guy who's 7'5", you know, you see these guys who have no agility when they're over seven foot two. They have none, except for probably Chris Stapps, I would say, is probably one that is probably closer to one, be at 7'3", who's able to score, who's able to shoot, but he ain't no Victor. Chris Stapps ain't no Victor, not even remotely close. It's almost like scary because you never have seen anything like this in the NBA, and probably we never will ever again. And what Wemby has done in not only this season, but the past couple seasons, he's getting better and better and better and better and better. Not only that, and taller and taller. But you kind of just sit and you kind of just watch the best of the best do it. And you just kind of gather information throughout these NBA games and kind of just believe that this is natural, and it's not at all. We will constantly be surprised by this guy every single season, in every single game, and every single half, and every single quarter, and every single minute that he is on the court, he will surprise us. Not only that, he is leading his team to 3-0, which we haven't seen in a while. Teams that are able to be 3-0 in the first couple of their games are usually the people who either crash down to the bottom because it's a fluke first three wins, or they're able to play as a team for the rest of the season and become top contenders in their conference. And right now, right at this moment, this team is not a fluke. Not even remotely close a fluke. They obviously have only played Brooklyn and New Orleans first, which stinks. But Wemby fouled out in the Pelicans game. No, in the Brooklyn game. And they won. And that's what I think is so special about this team. There are so many young guys on this team who are young, healthy guys who can play. They absolutely can ball. And if you have your best guy out, and it will probably be your franchise player for the next 14 years, if you see guys backing him up, I don't really understand why this team wouldn't be considered great because of them being able to back up one of the best players being on the bench. Obviously, people can say that when, you know, the Sixers win with Joel Embiid on the bench, but the Sixers are not. The Sixers had 25 wins last season. Not even close. Not even remotely close. How much weight to place on the first week? Are they trends or are they noise? You don't really see, you know, trends and noises are a big thing in the NBA. At the start of the NBA season, so hard to find out in the first week, like in the first 3 or 4 weeks of the NFL season, it is impossible to predict. It is impossible to predict anything that is happening in the NBA, anything that is happening in the NFL. Like I just said, you sit back and you watch and you just gather your own information for yourself. And that's why I'm doing this podcast, is because I'm just sharing my opinion. I'm sharing what I believe is, you know, valuable information to people who want to know more about sports, who want to hear other people's opinions and other people's looks. My looks, obviously, I believe that my looks are, you know, the best looks, because obviously you're self-biased to everything you say, but you see these early signs of chemistry that these teams have. You don't even know how to kind of gather information through the first week of the NBA, because it's like, wow, these teams have only played 3 games. How do I think about this? It's hard to think about it. And players are only getting better and better, with 11 players averaging 30-plus points. Something you never see. You never see that ever. And with rule changes, like any shot taken from 36-plus feet in the final 3 seconds of the first three quarters will count as a team shot attempt, but not as an individual shot attempt. And also, what I think is a huge huge issue in the NBA, which actually, I mean, I think basically everybody in the country has heard of this, just because it's not only big in the NBA, but also big, you know, just in general news. Serious legal betting issues already with Terry Rozier and Chauncey Billups. They're betting basically against themselves. Like Terry Rozier, you see clips of Terry Rozier purposely turning the ball over. It is so blatantly obvious that he is turning the ball over on purpose that you just see some speculation that it's just like, why does he look like he's just playing lazy? This isn't how Terry Rozier plays. And then when you realize that when Terry Rozier and Chauncey Billups are making bets with the Italian mafia, that is definitely not helpful at all. Look at this info and you're just like almost awestruck, because there's been so many betting allegations that have been put against people. But now this isn't one that you just kind of ignore, because this is like a serious issue. This is a real, real issue between a finals MVP and a finals champion, Chauncey Billups, who is not even a player. He's a coach. And then Terry Rozier, who is a fantastic role player. You don't like these players who are high profile people in the NBA. It's a serious issue in the NBA, because like now you almost wonder what other people are involved in this. Who's going to be involved? Like, how is this going to end? It's like, how do you prevent betting in the NBA? You don't. You have to rely on people to trust other people. You have to be like, okay, this guy bet on one NCAA game and he's an NBA athlete. You can't do that. You just have to rely on these people to not do that. And with so many people that the hold accountable in the NBA, is almost impossible. And so like Adam Silver releases all these statements about you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. He's just saying them to the public. He's just saying them. He's not going into full interrogation of these NBA players. He's just releasing the rules and releasing what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. It is not his job to go around and interrogate players constantly over and over and over again. And you can't stop it. You can't prevent a way to have all these NBA players not bet. It is just the way that the game is. Just the way that the game is. You can't rely on every single NBA player just to obey the rules constantly. Yes, being in the NBA is a huge, huge deal. It is a business. It is not even fun. It is a business. You can get traded at any point. NBA rules could happen. Threats could happen to you. Anything can happen in the NBA. Yes, it is an amazing and fun job, but you don't know what's going to happen. The NBA is unpredictable. News is unpredictable, and all this other stuff is unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen at all. What evidence will prosecutors present? Will others be implicated? What happens to broadcasting prop bets? Impact on team and league culture. Like I said, with league culture, team culture, it is a huge, huge, huge issue that we have seen for decades. Is sports betting. It has been an issue with players all the time. You see it with Odell handing out money to LSU when they became the national champions in football. He's handing them stacks of money. You cannot do that. You can't do that. You cannot bet against other people. You can't bet against yourself. No betting, period. You can't do any of it, let alone with the mafia. You can't do any of that stuff. It is absolutely prohibited. I'm surprised that they haven't just fired Chauncey Billups straight away, and they haven't just released Terry Rozier and be banned from the NBA. I'm surprised they have not done that. You see it with Jontay Porter. The same thing happened with Jontay Porter. He bet and he found out the consequences of betting. You don't there's obviously more key things to all of this. And what I'm reading here, the fact that both a current player and a high-profile coach are implicated raises serious integrity issues in the NBA. It's simply not about one fringe player. This touches major figures. This isn't some player who's sitting on the bench. This isn't some stupid 21-year-old who just got into sports betting. This isn't that. This is a role player who plays every single game for 25-plus minutes a game. This is a real, real NBA player and a really, really good NBA coach. And by the way, a coach is supposed to be a mentor. if your mentor is betting against and with your team, with the mafia behind your back secretly, you have some team issues. You have some horrible culture issues that are going to happen in the NBA. What is Portland going to look like? We don't know. We don't know. They lost a unbelievably fantastic veteran to something that is idiotic, stupid, and should not have any place in the NBA. Nowhere near. Nowhere close. There are obviously huge, huge, huge details in this. But in Rozier's case, the NBA reportedly investigated earlier in 2023 and found no violation, which means that this is recent. This is very recent. What could happen next? You don't know what could happen next. Like, you don't know. Someone could have just placed a bet with a huge, huge figure like the mafia. They could have placed it 5 days ago and we have no idea because the NBA does not check for it. You have to hold these players accountable by telling them what to do strongly. You can't hold them accountable by checking their phone. You can't be like, okay, let me see your phone every week. That's dumb. That's a horrible way. That is so inefficient. So at this point, you have to think that these players are going to hold themselves accountable and you have to trust these NBA players because they are adults. They are people who know the consequences of basketball. They know the consequences of betting. And you just have to realize that, okay, they haven't been caught yet. Let's just wait now. And that's what it is at this point. You don't know if someone's betting. You just don't know. Like, for all we know, Giannis could be betting. LeBron could be betting. Luka could be betting. Wemby could be betting. Like, you just don't know. If performance or availability can be tipped or manipulated for bets, the sport's competitive legitimacy is at risk. You don't know. It's illegal. Illegal stuff should not happen in the NBA. It shouldn't happen anywhere, let alone the NBA. You don't know what this is going to look like for people later on with so many young people. They come into a generation where young people, you know, they are raised in this generation. It's so much differently than, you know, different than how Steph was, how Giannis was. Because you have social media, you have your phone. They didn't have betting online back then. They didn't have any of that big betting stuff happening back then. It wasn't a thing. So this is kind of what we know so far about the current situation. So on Terry Rozier, he's obviously a current guard for the Miami Heat, and he was arrested on October 23rd, 2025 as a part of a broad federal probe into illegal sports betting operations. Rozier allegedly provided non-public information about his own performance and or game participation to associates who placed bets, which were unders, based on the inside tip. So he was basically failing on purpose so these people could get more money and so he can get more money. Example cited on March 13, 2023. While with the Charlotte Hornets, Rozier is said to have told someone that he would leave the game early with a purported injury. Bettors allegedly wager more than $200,000 that he would underperform his statistical line. He left the game after under 9 minutes. His lawyer has denied wrongdoing, calling the case a non-case and saying Rozier is not a gambler. But with evidence like this, you say that that is a bunch of BS and that is not true. The NBA has placed him on leave currently right now, which I am honestly surprised of considering that what they did to Jonte Porter a couple years ago with sports betting. And then with the side of Chauncey Billups, who is the head coach for the Portland Trail Blazers, was also arrested in the same sweep through his alleged involvement in a somewhat different scheme. In Billups' case, federal authorities allege he was involved in rigged high-stakes poker games dating back to 2019 with ties major New York mafia families. So basically, he's playing high-profile poker games with huge members of the Italian mafia and their families, which is almost even hard to think about. The scheme allegedly used advanced technology to cheat participants. So he's not only playing with the mafia, he's cheating on the mafia, which is not probably something that you want to do or want to try to do. And additionally, in one of the indictments, there's a mention of an unnamed conspirator 8, an Oregon resident NBA player from 1997 to 2014, coached since 2021, who allegedly tipped off gamblers about a game involving the Trailblazers, the description matches Billups' timeline. So we know this because we are getting insider information from other people that are matching the timelines with what people say that Chauncey Billups did and what other people are saying Chauncey Billups did. Billups obviously denies the allegations, and his attorney claims he would not risk his Hall of Fame legacy for such an activity. He was too placed on an administrative leave by the NBA. And with his attorney saying that he would not risk his Hall of Fame legacy for such activity, apparently he does. Apparently he will. Apparently he doesn't care that much. Apparently he is going to... Apparently he's going to put his legacy in the line for money. People are gamblers. There are so many people who have gambling addictions, including coaches, including players, which sucks to see. And you have this tendency as a player because it is so easy to bet because you know all the insider, but you can't. And that is what I think drives these players to do that, because it is more cash for them. It is more cash for other people. It is more cash for themselves. And a lot of people are greedy. A lot of these players are greedy people, which sucks to see because you already have these people making millions and millions and millions of dollars a year. Like, what's another $10,000 going to do? Like, what are they going to do with that? Like, it's just like, you can't do that, like, at all. It's just dumb. It's just a dumb thing to do, stupid thing to do, idiotic thing to do. And it's almost unbelievable to even think about. And a lot of people are saying, and the schemes involve insider information, manipulation of performance / availability, and possibly rigged events like poker connected to organized crime. So it's not just some big bets, but it's literal wrongdoing. Like, it's a literal crime. Like, it's not just a crime against the NBA. It's not against NBA regulations and rules. It is legitimately illegal. It is illegal to do that. Like, you're stealing other people's money. It's theft. It is literally theft. And you're in your 50s as a coach, and you're committing theft against other people who not only are regular people, but are people who are considered some of the dangerous groups of people in the world. And you're going to not only put that on you, but put that on your team. So what are they going to do if they don't come after you? They're going to come after your team. They're going to come after your fans. They're going to come after the NBA as a whole. This affects the entire NBA. And it should affect the entire NBA. And this should be a wake-up call to multiple, multiple people and multiple teams. You are putting yourself against, not only putting yourself against the mafia, but putting the entire NBA against the mafia. And I know that this sounds super cheesy and super corny, but it's a legitimate threat. Like, it is like a legitimate thing that people should worry about. And it's almost unbelievable that this is even a thing. So how do we see this at the end? We honestly just see people firing Chauncey Billups and banning Terry Rozier from the NBA. This is all because then it doesn't pose a threat to the NBA at all. He has no relation to them. I'm not going to go after the players because now Chauncey doesn't have a relation to them. And scary. There are crazy things happening in the NBA right now, and they're only going to get crazier with more news like this might be happening. It's literally the first week. It is the first week, and all this stuff has already happened. And I'm not only concerned, but also I am very, very excited to see what this upcoming week and upcoming not only week, but also month that this NBA has for players' performance and other news that we could be covering. Don't want to cover injuries, obviously. I mean, it'd be a great thing to cover, but obviously you don't want to wish injuries against anybody. But this season's going to be fun. It's going to be a fun season, and I can't wait to see how the season's going to play out. That's going to do it for today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to Starting Five. This is your host, Scotty McIntyre, and I will see you another time. Peace.
Big Sky Small World is sponsored by the Carroll College Communication Center.
Helping the Carroll and Helena communities with presentations, multimedia, and podcasting since 2020.
Find us in the library or email Director Alan Hansen at ahansen@carroll.edu.
Hi, this is Hazel. Today, I want to share my story of seeing the aurora in Yellowknife. When I first saw the aurora in Yellowknife, Canada, I was disappointed. For years, I had imagined the northern lights as brilliant green waves covering the night sky. They were supposed to move like silk in a wind, bright enough to light up the snow. That was the image I had seen countless times on travel websites, postcards, and social media. But when I finally saw them in person, they were not what I expected. The sky was pale and quiet. The aurora looked almost white. It moved gently with no sound, no brightness, and no strong color. For a moment, I thought I might be looking at the thin layer of cloud instead of the famous aurora borealis. That evening, I was standing on a frozen lake outside Yellowknife. It was around minus 30 degrees Celsius, and the air was completely still. Above me, a soft, milky band of light stretched across the horizon. It was real, but it was not a vibrant scene that I had imagined for so long. I took a few photos, and only then did I realize what the camera saw. On the screen, the light appeared clearly green, as if it had come from a different sky. My eyes saw white, but the camera saw color. That difference stayed in my mind long after I returned from the trip. Later, I learned that my experience was very common. Human eyes are less sensitive to color in low light. At night, when light levels are weak, our eyes rely mainly on red cells, which can detect brightness but not hue. That is why many people see the aurora as white or gray, even though its actual color is green. A camera, however, keeps its lens open for several seconds, collecting more light and amplifying colors that our eyes cannot process in real time. In other words, the aurora never lies. The limitation is in our vision. Knowing that made me feel different about what I saw. The pale light over the lake was not disappointing anymore. It was simply how nature appeared to my eyes. The real sky was there, unchanged. Only my expectation had been exaggerated by images and videos. After returning from Yellowknife, I began to wonder whether people could see the aurora in other parts of North America. At first, I thought it was something that existed only near the Arctic Circle. But the aurora is more dynamic than I imagined. It follows the Earth's magnetic field, and during periods of strong solar activity, the glowing oval around the pole expands southwards. In the United States, the aurora can be seen more often than many people think. It appears regularly in Alaska, but it is also occasionally visible in states such as Montana, North Dakota, and Minnesota. When solar storms are particularly strong, even residents of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Oregon can observe faint lights near the northern horizon. This aurora may not be bright and most appear pale rather than green, but they are still the same phenomenon. And I currently live in Helena, Montana. Helena lies close to the southern edge of the auroral zone. Most nights here are too quiet to reveal any trace of northern lights. Yet on some rare occasion, the aurora does reach this far. In May 2024, a major geomagnetic storm made aurora visible throughout the northern United States. People in Helena reported seeing pink and green glows flickering above the surrounding mountains. It lasted only for a short time, but it proved that the same solar energy that lights the Arctic sky can travel thousands of kilometers south and touch this region as well. When I remember the aurora I saw in Yellowknife, I no longer think about disappointment. The white light I witnessed was not less real than the green one in photographs. It was simply what the human eye could perceive at that moment. That experience has changed how I look at the night sky. The aurora is not only about color or beauty. It is about distance, perception, and connection. It reminds me that even faint light can travel across the world, and that the same energy illuminating the Arctic can also reach the quiet sky of Montana. Perhaps that is enough reason to keep looking up. Big sky, small world, like a high Montana.
Thank you for tuning in to Big Sky, Small World. The Theme music is by Alex Coulter. Follow us on Instagram at bigsky.smallworld. Tune in next week.